All right, folks, welcome to this session on possible patterns for interaction and navigation. I hope some of you did that little preliminary test there. I know that there wasn't a lot of time. If you were to fill that out completely, if you were to fill your list to what you could think of, let's say in 10 or 15 minutes of sitting there, what would you estimate the count on that list to be? I'd be interested. What do you think? 25? No, you wouldn't get 25? 4? That's more typical, I think. 5? 10? 11? 2? You need to be in this session, I'll tell you that. So, if you are the sort of folks who, if you're the person that said 25, then you may not learn very much in this session. If you're saying, well, I thought a half a dozen, then this session will be more beneficial to you. So I just warn you that up front. As you can see, there is a broad range here. One of the toughest things we do at this conference is to try to make a session that appeals to and addresses as broad a range as possible. But I give you that warning up front so that you won't sit here and get to the end and go, I knew everything you said. Now, in fact, some of you, almost everybody in here, is going to look at some of the things I say and go, oh yeah, I knew that. But the question is not, did you know it? The question is, did you know it well enough to use it at the point that you need it to create some new designs for the interaction pattern that you'll use in your application for your users and your circumstances? So one of the best ways to think about this session is as a checklist to use as a resource in the future. I'm going to go through a host of applications, navigation patterns and interaction patterns, with examples for each, some cautions in using them, some indications for when you ought to think about using them. There are about 24 in this list. And then I hope that, keep the slide deck, you pull it back out in your design sessions so you can just trot down and look at all the possibilities and see, have I considered that, all those possibilities or not? Now, the reason this is important is that, as I said in my session on Monday, we are tasked with greater responsibility than we used to be in taking care of our users. We've pretty much been able to get away with just throwing options on the screen in some menu with 300 items in it. And the users just had to put up with that. But now we're into an era with where their exposure to technology comes in the form of touch-based devices with exquisitely beautiful user interfaces, well-crafted, well-designed, and we need to step up our game in order to not be displaced by people who know how to do that sort of thing better than we do. Fortunately, I'm going to tell you something straight up, because this is something that that the bulk of designers seem to have some real fear about. They don't really have the confidence that they can go into this area. Look, I work with teams all over the world in redesigning their applications. I have never failed to go into a team where 90% of the people there couldn't learn how to do things like this and participate enough in the world of design to do a dramatically better job than they're doing today. So I want to give you that confidence to start with. Here is the basic list that we're going to cover today. It starts from the more commonly used ones. I'll be going through those pretty quickly. Then I'll get to the ones that are somewhat lesser used that you might not think of. At every stage, I'll show you an example. In many cases, cautions, as I said, and indications. When I get to the end for a couple of them, the timeline and the viewport, I will show you an actual implementation of them in XAML that you can have if you want. Most of them you know how to implement. You know how to implement a list and a list box. I don't have to tell you how to do that. But as you get to some of the more complex ones, there are some interesting technical tips. Besides that, I'm pretty sure there's a guy standing outside that door, and if I don't crack open Visual Studio and do some work in it before the end of the session, he will arrest me and take me out of the building. So, at the end, I will do a couple of implementations just to show you what advanced UI can do if you understand some of the maybe not obvious capabilities inside of it. All right, so let's start going down our list then. The one you're easily the most familiar with is lists of options. This includes things like the standard menu on the top or a tree-based side menu. Those, in my opinion, those are pretty much functionally equivalent. And what most people do with those is they just keep streaming options in them because they They don't know any better. They just completely overwhelm people with options. But this particular pattern can be used intelligently. You will often see it, for example, on mobile apps, like that sample screen right there, where here are the things that you're able to do with this application. Let's use that as a stepping off point. So it can be a simple list. Also, in many cases, you want to decide whether or not this is a good idea based on the following considerations. Is the app simple enough, or do you have to conform to some older standards? Another case in which you tend to use these kinds of especially these long options that you see, these huge menus that you see, is we've been told we're supposed to assemble our application composite with a composite pattern on the fly. Well, in that case, we don't know all the options that we're going to have to load when we create the shell that's going to run them. So this is a pretty easy way for us to just plug in new options on the fly if we're not too worried about whether or not it's a good experience for the user. And of course, in many cases, I find this is the default choice because people are just too lazy to go through and figure out a good way that matches what the users really need. So this almost should be your last resort in many respects, especially the very complex menus. For a simple app with a simple list, I think it's okay. But I do not believe my team will ever again produce an application with file, edit, window, help along the top. We will never do that again. That is a paradigm for an obsolete age that was created with the idea of the GUI. The GUI is over 30 years old. We've moved on to completely new form factors and completely new UI stacks, and it's time to move on and leave file, edit, window, help behind. I said that 4 years ago, and people said, Billy, you're absolutely nuts. Where's the file edit window help in Windows 8? Except for the desktop legacy mode. So, now, cautions. As I said, don't make your list too long. Respect Hick's Law. Hick's Law is a design principle. It's based on some science. You can go look it up on Wikipedia and get the mathematical equations in it. But what it basically says is that the time required for the user to locate and use an option gets bigger as if the user must choose from many, many options. So what that means is every time you add an option to a list, you are slowing the user down and using all the other options. Therefore, you need to respect that and not make the list too big. If you do have to have huge lists, then you need to look at dynamic filtering and finding capability. Or you need to look at lists of favorites, so once the user finds the option they want, they don't keep having to go back through the tree to find it. You can look at most recently used options, a box that when they find something, it just automatically pops up there. It's easy for them to get to next. Or you can look at role-based subsets, so the menu dynamically changed based on the role. They only see the limited number of things that they need to see. Those are all possibilities if you must use option lists. And in the modern UI world, you are expected to do that sort of thing. To a typical pattern, if you've just got a simple list, is to put some kind of find capability at the bottom as one option, possibly combined with another option, which is to categorize the available things at the bottom. That's a typical layout pattern that you might see, especially in a mobile type of scenario. Okay, so that's option lists. Launch pads. These have various names, sometimes called springboards or a hub and spoke pattern. These have different, they're basically different variants of these. There's the application-centric launch pad. The typical desktop meets that description. The Windows 8 desktop meets that. The Metro, the iPad meets that. But then we also get into, I didn't realize that was on a delay there. The iPad desktop meets that. A lot of operating system desktops meet that. But it's also useful inside applications. For example, an action-centric launch pad is used in products like Camtasia. What kind of action do I want to do when I first enter the application? And you can also have entity-centric launch pads. What kind of entity do I want to work with right now? That one on the top there is from an application some of you have seen me demonstrate called Staff Links. We're very entity-centric there because the users in that case think about the application in terms of their entities. What employees are they going to work with, temporary employees, what customers, what orders. Their thinking about the workflow is entity-centric, so we make the launch pad entity-centric. The bottom screen there is from one of my clients from Brazil. Gustavo, are you here? So if you like that, Gustavo down in Brazil at IdealSoft produced that. Again, it's more of a, let's let you get to the category of entities that you're interested in working with. So that's the different kinds of launch pads that you can do. Now, what are the indications for use of that? Well, if you want immediate familiarity, everybody knows what a desktop looks like. And even if you don't, the iPad, for example, they've taken the iPad and given it to two-year-olds and they figure out how to use it. They took it into the mountains in Chile to people who had never seen a computer in their life. And in a minute or two, they learned to use it. So the Launchpad is a nice, ubiquitous form of navigation pattern that people pick up very quickly. If you have dynamically loaded options and you really don't have any good categorization, they just kind of come in at random. You think of, you're getting apps for your system and they're just coming in and you don't really have any particular way to organize them. You may want to give the user some way to manage how the apps are spaced around. Or if you desire to conform to the metaphor for the platform that you're on. If you're going to be on Windows 8, you might want your app's control screen to be somewhat consistent with Metro's desktop, in which case this would be an interaction pattern that you would want to consider. Now, the cautions on launch pads. One of them is make sure your cosmetics are different enough that the user isn't easily confused. That it's pretty clear, even though you want to use the same general style, you want enough visual difference that it's very clear without them having to look at a title bar or something that they're on your app's launch pad instead of the desktop launch pad. So do be careful that you keep things kind of different. And then again, respect Hick's Law. The one thing not to do on launch pads is have the giant block of identically sized buttons with random icons on them, okay? And I have seen this used in far too many real applications because it's really easy to do, right? You just kind of throw the buttons in there and you go off to some free icon library and pick the first icon that vaguely looks like something that might be different from the other icons. So be careful that you do keep the number down and that you make the individual options pretty obvious in terms of what they do and how they differ from one another. This particular one right here, for example, is I saw in some real production applications used by doctors. I think you guys, if you came last year, you may have seen me talk about this. And what you really want to do is have a small number of options with maybe an advanced area, because this is just too many for people to look at all at once. Also, there's another design principle called Fitt's Law. All of your buttons, all of your launch options don't have to be the same size. Windows 8 Metro embraces this, right? Some of the things on the Windows 8 Metro that take up multiple of those little blocks. They're bigger than other things. And presumably, if your app has any kind of rationality to it, the bigger things would be the more important things that people would want to use more often. All right? Now, notice this is the first time I'm going to mention this, but this is a recurring theme. You can do combinations. These navigation patterns are certainly not exclusive to one another. You may use one pattern at one interaction point and another at a different interaction point. It's very common for us if we produce a shell that handles multiple applications within an organization. We want one unified login, but when they come in, we have a launch pad for the type of application they want to run, choosing from three or four possibilities. If you saw the screen in Camtasia does that there is one launch pad type pattern there, but once you've chosen that, you go to another interaction pattern that we're going to get to later. So you can have different interaction patterns at different points in the application. There are all kinds of interesting combinations that you can use. That's where the interesting challenge in design comes. But today I'm not going to talk too much about the combinations except to point out that they are there and that you should be aware of them and you should be creative in coming up with combinations of patterns that might suit your particular needs. All right. Wizards, you guys all know wizards. Multiple steps, with or without branching. A checkout process would be a typical example. The ubiquitous features there would be a progress indicator and something for forward and backward navigation in the wizard. Each step in the wizard accomplishes a certain thing. You guys know when to use this, right? If you've got a constant stream of new users that are only going to use the application a few times, a wizard is a good choice. Also, if you have a process that's pretty complex, but the users don't do it very often. They do it once a month or once a year. They may keep coming back to it, but but they just don't use it daily. A wizard in that case is good. You typically don't want to use wizards in situations where people are going to have to keep going through it, unless you can make that wizard so bloody fast to navigate through that it doesn't slow them down. And I've actually done that. I've had wizards where for applications where doctors were evaluating x-rays and such, and they've got a little button thing in their hand to, you know, if it's normal, click, 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 until they get to the point where they have to do something. So you can write wizards in such a way as to not slow people down, but you typically need some kind of external, very fast way for them to navigate through it, for them to do that. They were actually holding a thing in their hand with buttons on it in that application. So that's wizards. Then, of course, we have wizards lead to the general idea of backward and forward linear navigation. That's when you have arbitrary views that you need to show the user. The user needs to use them, and you just want to chain them together. The classic website navigation is the case there. That's typically used for applications that are content-centric, because if you are on one screen for a long time and you're doing a lot of work on that screen, then mentally there's sort of a radioactive decay process going on in your brain of what else is in the stack. The longer you work on one screen, the less likely that if the user works on one screen a long time, they will tend to forget what else is in the stack. So they'll stop, that navigation becomes less useful to them as they forget what else is they can access with forward and back. So if it's content-centric and mostly consumption-oriented, or if you need a navigation pattern that just about everybody understands, because everybody pretty much understands the web. But don't assume too much there. You'd be surprised at that, because we've done usability observation studies. You'd be surprised how many web users never use the back button. All they do is favorites or something to get to where they want. You'd be surprised how many do that. There's master detail with drill down. That's when you want navigation based on the structure of your data. You've got some kind of hierarchical relationship in the data, and you want the navigation to reflect that hierarchical structure. The canonical example is when we browse through a file system. Again, that's a pretty familiar pattern there. And then there's drill down. You see one particular subset of the data. You have some means of drilling down on that, and then the view changes to a more detailed view of that particular chunk of things. So master detail and drill down are one of your navigation patterns. You typically want to do that only if the users are very familiar with the data structures involved. We presume at this point that just about everybody understands folder structures on a computer. Actually, though, if you'll notice, a lot of newer platforms like the iPad don't have such a paradigm in them. So don't be too sure about using that. There's certainly a class of consumers for which that folder-based navigation paradigm isn't necessarily so obvious. Another reason that you want to consider this as your navigation pattern is when the user's path through the data is inherently unpredictable, that you have no particular way of knowing how they're going to go down the tree. The tree is pretty complex. You have no way to predict where they're going next, so you can't help them. You pretty much have to turn that responsibility over to them. If you can help them, if you can predict what they're going to do with a fairly high degree of reliability, then this is typically not the pattern that you'd want to use then. Now, some of the cautions here, you normally would like to couple this with two things. One is some kind of search capability that manages the amount of data that's being navigated. This is where Windows doesn't do a particularly good job. I find that the desktop search to narrow down is just not a particularly good design, even though the normal drill down is a pretty good design. You also may need a find capability. Now notice that these are two different things. The search capability says, please go to the database and find all the things that match this. And now I've got a list that's sitting on the client that they're working with. The find capability is, let me filter within this list that I already have to screen it down to what I need. And that I find among developers is the capability that they leave off most often. It really frustrates me to have just fetched 250 items and realized I need to filter it to get down to the 15 I want. And I know what word will do that, but there's no way to do it. Now I have to go back and search and wait for the delay again to go back to the server. Even Amazon gets this one wrong. Amazon gets so many things right in user experience, but their product search thing needs better filtering than it's got now. They have some categorization filtering, which is another option, but I wish they just had a simple find. Usually, if the data is at all complicated, you'd like some collapse all or return to root to kind of do a reset. Because typically what's happening here is the user goes down one path and they finish what they're doing, and then they start a different task, which requires them to begin again at the beginning. So you want to have some easy way for them to get back to that. It's frustrating to the user to have to backtrack all the way through the tree to get back to the root when they are not the least bit interested in those intermediary steps. Okay, so that's master detail with drill down. Then we've got document or view centric. Applications don't often do this. Business applications don't, but there are certainly situations where they do, and you're very familiar with it. A typical example would be a document writer such as Word, or a layout based content creator, PowerPoint or Illustrator. Or you see, I've got a screen there for Expression Blend. That's the dark screen, and the light screen there is Corel Draw. There's the common elements that you see in this kind of navigation pattern is a visual surface of some kind that reflects the layout that the user is trying to do, and then some kind of toolbox or toolbar capability to pick the things that are going to go on the view, and then some other windows that let you select options or change properties or things like that. Notice that Visual Studio is in this family, but it has both modes. That basically, when you edit code, it's in the document mode. But when you go to a visual designer for XAML or Windows Forms or something, you're in the layout mode. So it actually implements both patterns depending upon the context of what kind of thing you're working on right now. So that's the document or view-centric model. You want to do that if the users need very detailed control over some kind of layout and choose the elements that they're going to lay out. Or if the task flow through configuring something is extremely hard to predict. But you want to make sure that the users can tolerate a pretty long learning process. This kind of navigation pattern is for users that can handle pretty high cognitive load, and they're prepared to invest some time in learning. For casual users, you want to find typically a different pattern. Maybe there are n number of configurations they typically choose, so you just let them choose from the n instead of detail putting the individual elements on. So that's document or view centric. A relative of that, of course, is spreadsheets. Sort of Office covers both the two you just saw plus this one, where you've got spreadsheets are appropriate to a flat data structure for the most part, and when you want to do editing in the cells. I am not a huge fan of spreadsheets, as people who have had my training and have listened to me before know. It's not that I don't think they have places where they should be applied. I do, in fact. I think there are several places where spreadsheets work very well, but I think that they are overused in current technologies. Here are the situations where I do think they work well. If you need flexible sort capability among the records that come back, the spreadsheets are really good at that. If you're not really sure exactly which subfields the user is going to be interested in, then the ability to drag columns around is a strength of the spreadsheet type interaction pattern. If your users are accountants, boy, they love their spreadsheets. But I find that the most common indication of why somebody used a spreadsheet pattern is that they're too lazy to find something better. That you don't really have to get inside the user's mind and understand much about what they're doing with this particular navigation pattern. You just dump the data on the screen and let them figure it out. Well, if that's your reason for using a spreadsheet, then I think you need to back off and maybe consider some other patterns in this world where we're trying to make things easier than we did before. So don't do one out of laziness. Also, almost all modern spreadsheets include a card view capability of some kind, and you can spoof it even if they don't, and that's a pretty good navigation pattern, kind of with master detail there. Also, modern UI, such as XAML, includes data templating capability. When we do use a spreadsheet, we tend to make the spreadsheet navigation pattern. We tend to make the cells themselves templated to show exactly what they need to show, not just a simple single element in each cell. We will sometimes combine elements in a single cell in some interesting way that the user needs to visualize the data. So let's see what else. Context switchers. In many cases, the user is doing different things, which corresponds to different contexts. The app offers them differing functional areas that they need to work with. So we're pretty familiar with context switchers that we might use. Most of us tend to use tabs for that, tab controls for that. Nothing wrong with tab navigation as long as you don't get too crazy about it and as long as you categorize the tabs very nicely. If your tabs are pretty much random, then that's not good. If you've got 15 tabs and tons of stuff on there, you better get some find capability or something for people to locate what they need. We're going to revisit that that aspect in a few minutes when I talk about the ribbon. The panorama is another context switcher. You see that in the lower right corner there. The panorama has different contexts, and you swish back and forth very naturally. It's a good adaptation to the fact that we just don't have a very large screen. Notice that there are visual cues there. The pattern typically has a piece of the next panel that is going to come into play. In older user interface technologies, where we thought of the screen as kind of a fixed thing, that would have been considered sloppy because there wasn't any easy way to get over to it. But in the touch-based world, that's considered to be a perfectly fine design, that you show a sliver over there as the visual indication that says, yep, swipe right across the screen and you'll get more stuff. But more typical tab layouts are like that Starbucks app there, where we've got some kind of thing along the bottom that when I press that, it switches the context. If I want to find stores, that's one screen. If I want to order a drink, that's another, et cetera. So that's the more typical case for folks like you. The middle one there is the Amazon Kindle Fire, and that has basically a tabbed metaphor for their home-based screen, where I can go to newsstand, books, music, video, docs. Each of those will then bring up its own contextual area for me to work in. So that's those are examples of context switchers. Another example of a context switcher is a carousel, where you've got the thing you're working on big, and the next thing next to it on each side is smaller and kind of shrunk down. You know, that looks really good. It turns out that users don't like it much. So you have a hard time finding examples in the real world of that. As sweet as that looks, to watch that carousel rotate and the stuff come on, it turns out that people get tired of that really quick. And that brings up a fundamental design principle to keep in mind when you're evaluating the navigation pattern that you want. Don't get seduced into doing something fancy that's not going to wear well, that people aren't going to like after they've used the app for a long time. That's why you want to push out there and do something different because we're in a new age, but don't be gratuitous about the stuff that you add to the app, especially with things like animations and such. So indications for context switchers, if there are several categories of functionality that are pretty much unrelated, or you just got too much data for one screen and you have natural categories, and when you also want to use most of the screen for that mode of functionality, you don't have to share the screen between two different records or views or something like that. As soon as the one place that the tabbed metaphor starts to break down is when I start having to share the screen between two views. It doesn't work as well. Then there are toolbars and ribbons. These are usually pretty action-oriented, primarily for interaction, doing things, rather than navigation, going to things. But there are exceptions to that. For example, in PowerPoint itself, there is a place on the ribbon where you navigate to the master view for the slide. And that's the only way to get there, as far as I know. The ribbon is an interesting navigation pattern. It has certainly received a lot of attention because of its use in Office. And as developers, there's something you need to understand about it. And I'm going to have to ask this question again, even though I did discuss this briefly on Monday. How many of you like the ribbon? How many of you don't like the ribbon? Okay, so you can see the hands. That's pretty typical when I talk to developer crowds. The important thing to understand about the ribbon is it's not designed for you. And that's why it succeeds in the applications, because developers tend to think about things in other navigation patterns. The complexity of Visual Studio, which I think actually could be improved, by the way, but it's so complex that most people would never figure Visual Studio out. Look, how many of you, do your parents not have a clue what you really do for a living? Okay? So, you know, when you're in the profession that you might as well put magical wizard on your card, then yes, you can take something that's pretty complex. But for the vast majority, or the huge array of the usual users out there, they can't handle those kind of navigation patterns. You have to design for them. The ribbon is created for them. Now, I've worked with companies that implemented the ribbon in new software. For example, I worked with a company that does government software. They put software into governmental offices. And they were switching from character-based stuff. And they kept the ribbon down to a fairly modest number of tabs on the ribbon and number of things on each tab, and the users loved it. It was just immediately obvious to them they could switch among the four tabs. There's 8 or 10 options on each. That's a small enough number that that it works pretty well. When you're in that territory, I think the ribbon is a perfectly acceptable navigation option. Now, I will say that Office, to me, takes it too far. It's too complex. 2 weeks ago, I wanted to turn off the people pane in Outlook, and I spent, I don't remember how long I spent, 15 minutes trying to find that option on the ribbon. Never did. Went to Google to finally locate where it was on the ribbon. So, to me, the ribbon would be dramatically improved, and there's nothing preventing you from doing this in your own apps now if you had somewhere else a find capability to light up the things that somebody would like to find. Light up the tabs, and when they go to that tab, light up the options that match the particular find capability. I think that will dramatically improve a ribbon-type navigation option. Now, do be careful. Microsoft has some interesting patents on the ribbon, so you have to respect certain things about that, but you know, you can find out what the constraints are there yourself. Now, typically a ribbon, because it is for interaction, is associated with some contextual element, such as a document or view, or a toolbar, either one of those. There's the toolbar from Visual Studio. I'm going to tell you right now, most routine users don't like toolbars. The typical user, unless they have a fairly high cognitive load or they've used an application a lot that has toolbars in it and they're already accustomed to it, they typically don't like toolbars. So typically you don't want to use that a lot. And then there is the gallery pattern. That is a visual array of items. Now we're starting to get into things that you're less likely to have used in your routine business applications. Here are a couple of examples of the gallery navigation pattern. When I'm in the Kindle and I go down to books, I get something that looks a whole lot like a bookshelf, and it's basically a gallery of the book covers that I can choose from in order to read a book. Media player has a gallery of the different albums that I can work with. So you want to use a gallery when the items have some visual image or icon associated with them, and that makes it very easy for the users to choose. Remember that the brain keys in on those visual images much, much faster than it does on any kind of text. Now, I don't have CDs in my car anymore, but when I did, I had colored Sharpies, and I used to sketch out a rough reproduction of the album cover on the CD. Because when I'm in a car fumbling trying to find the right CD, I don't want to be reading the titles. That's bad. Well, the same principle is at work here. That's why gallery works well. That there's some kind of visual tip-off that users immediately go, yep, that's the one I want. So if you don't have that kind of visualization, a gallery doesn't do you much good. Another place where the gallery shines is that you want to perform bulk actions on an item. You want to let the user select some things to delete it. You want to select some things and move it. That's where a gallery is a pretty good, because they can select pretty quickly and they can easily see which ones are selected. You can put some kind of highlighting on it. So that's the gallery pattern, some of the indications for use of that. Dashboards, that's where you typically have a combination of data visualization and navigation. You do typically want for that to be fairly fairly interactive in the sense that, let's see if I can get this guy over here working. Do I still have my thing? Just to kind of show you, I've shown this application. Some of you have seen it before, but please be patient, and I will only show it for a moment or two if you have already seen it. But to kind of emphasize the clickability of the dashboard, I thought I had loaded this up, but I didn't. It's a real application, so I have to load WCF services. OK. Okay, they're loaded. Log in. So the key in dashboards is that you design individual pieces of the dashboard to suit the roles that people have. And so up there, for in that area, are the things that the users might be interested in. You'd like it to be clickable so they can find out the detail, drill down into that if possible. You might want to have some collapsibility of elements if particular people aren't interested in them. So that's a typical dashboard. It's not uncommon with the dashboard pattern for it to be configurable in terms of what goes where, but the key thing is, for me, a well-designed dashboard has a fair amount of clickability built into it. But I don't just look at that item, I can actually click on it and navigate down to the place where that item suggests on the dashboard that I go. Now, a lot of people would think, gosh, dashboards, that's just not appropriate for mobile. Yeah, sure it is. Anytime that you're going to, that the user needs to pick an action based on decisions about data, that you don't know what they're going to do now, but to help them figure out what they're going to do, they need some information, then the dashboard navigation pattern is a good one. Even on mobile, you can see there's a sample screen there where you go into some kind of accounting function and you've got different parts of it. It's not a very sophisticated dashboard. You have to be very careful in terms of how many things you put on there and what your data visualization looks like. But there's no reason you can't use a dashboard on a mobile platform. No reason at all. I mean, you might normally naturally think about it just on a huge desktop, but it's not restricted to that. Another interaction pattern is queues. This is where the next item to work on is either automatically determined by the system and the user doesn't have any control at all. A typical example there, we wrote a system where pharmacists need to approve prescriptions. The prescriptions are being entered by somebody else. So there's always this continuous flow of new prescriptions that must be legally approved by a pharmacist before they can legally be packaged and shipped out. So the pharmacist just sits down and says, show me the next one. Yeah, that one looks good. Accept it. And then it pops up with the one after that, et cetera. So that's a typical queue-based architecture. And you might, in some cases, the user might be choosing from a small list. They have very limited control over that list, maybe no control. If you noticed, our dashboard had a little queue in it where there were action items. And again, the user doesn't have a lot of control. The system is figuring out those action items. The key in a queue is the user doesn't navigate to get them. And the user doesn't usually put in filters either. There might be two or three categories of queues that they go to, different queues. But usually the parameters that determine what a queue is are determined by the system and not by the user. Now, I find that the queuing navigation pattern is one of the most underused patterns in modern business software. If you look at modern business processes, you find queues all over the place. And what we do is we kind of fudge up queues in lists. And we don't really use a queue as effectively as a navigation pattern as we could. We can make people really productive with queue-based navigation patterns. Now, you do have to, so there are some things to be careful of. The queue works best when the workflow is extremely structured and very repetitive. That is, they're doing the same thing basically over and over again. And it's especially good if multiple users are working with the same set of pending items. So now I've got a navigation pattern where there's all these prescriptions coming in. Maybe I got three pharmacists approving them. That's the reason why when they ask for one, they don't know which one they're getting. It's whichever one's at the top right now. They get that one. The next person that asks gets the next one, and so on down the line. So anytime that you have that users sharing a bunch of work items that need to be taken care of, then the queue is good. Some cautions on using the queue navigation pattern. Make sure you build in forgiveness. Users tend to get in a rhythm, right? Oh yeah, that's fine, that's fine, that's fine. Oh wait, maybe it isn't, right? That there's something pattern matching that kicks in right after they hit the accept button. So it's fairly common in queue-based navigation patterns that when they press the accept, I'm done, or whatever, save, you don't actually commit to the database at that point. What we like to do is put it in some kind of little holding area. It's kind of sitting off there, not in their normal visual field, so it's not really bothering them, with some kind of a countdown that it's going to go through before it actually does commit. 15 seconds is a typical minimum for that. 30 seconds is a typical maximum. That's usually configured based on circumstances. Can be shorter or longer, but we find that's the typical range. So over here, an example there, you see the little green bars, the little green rectangles disappear as the countdown goes down, and they, at any point, if they go, oh no, oops, I didn't mean to do that, they can go and get that, and then it comes back. The item that came to them is put back on the queue, and then they get to go back and continue to work with that one. So you do want to use the design principle of forgiveness if you're going to do queues. What you don't want to use in a queue-based environment is the design principle of constraints, meaning, are you sure every time? And see, that would be the natural thing. Yes, you're approving that. Are you sure? That just becomes useless if they have to do it every time. That's just one more irritant click they have to go through. It won't help. So don't use confirmation. By the way, something to be aware of is when you get into queuing as a navigation interaction pattern, that has a bigger impact on overall architecture than the other patterns. Most of the other patterns, you get the data, you're on the client, you can do whatever you want to with it. But when you're looking at queuing architectures, that requires more infrastructure on the back end. You've got to choose your queuing technology. That can influence what the user is even able to do. If you use MSMQ, for example, you can't search the queues to find things or filter them. You can only get the top item. SQL Server has some pretty good queuing functionality built in that will do that. You should be familiar with some of the architectural patterns, such as a dispatch queue, that when a user is done with something, that it goes to this generic area with some kind of rules that decide which queue it goes to next. So be aware that there's architectural considerations if you get into queuing. But, as I said, queuing is underused, and if you want to have a huge impact on productivity, this is the interaction navigation pattern that, if it matches the workflow, will have the biggest impact in our experience on productivity. Configurators. This bears some resemblance to the layout type pattern that you saw earlier, but it's typically dramatically simpler, and it's intended for users that don't manage high cognitive load, that do just need to choose from certain options, but they need to see the implications of their options. They need to see some visual indication of what they've done. Here are a couple of example screens. I can actually show you these. I think I've got these loaded up. Here is, where's the... So, for example, here's the one with that little shed. Oops, let's put it over on the thing so that you can see it. Here we go. There's the one with the shed. So you select different options, and as you select what have we got here? Oh, the roofing instead of singers. Maybe I want asphalt black. We see that things actually change as we do it. So the user gets a very good idea based on everything that they're doing about what that particular shed's going to look like. So that's the configurator pattern. And you would normally think of it as physical objects like that. That's not the only thing that you can use it for. Here's a prototype that a member of my team did for another company. Is it here? Yeah, where basically this allows you to build a wedding invitation. And you pick the different things on it. You pick what shape you want it to be. And it's got an origami shape that unfolds. And you're actually able to go and edit the stuff on it directly on the thing there. And you can pick things like what paper color do you want and what little embellishments do you want. Right now we've got this little stone and that ribbon that goes up there. So you basically get to choose from various options and see what the end result is going to be. That's the company that commissioned this is actually doing it now with the wizard. And the wizard works okay, but they don't really see what the thing's going to look like till they get to the end. And now if they don't like it, they got to backtrack through the wizard to fix something. A configurator is a better option for when you need to see what the implications of a particular choice are. You could do configurators anytime there's some kind of real-world layout that's going on. Let's say, for example, you might use the configurator pattern if you were doing a warehouse application that required people to figure out how to load up trucks. You might have a visual thing showing where the loads went on the trucks, and they pick the loads, and you've got options for each load and things like that, and there's some visual indication of what that truck looks like when it's done. So the configurator pattern is good when you need to kind of, when a wizard isn't really good because you need better feedback about what the user's options are going to result in. The timeline interaction pattern, you're all familiar with that. That's when items have some kind of time span and calendar time associated with them. You will see both vertical and horizontal layouts there. And I'm going to show you in a moment the implementation of this, but let me first show you I did one of these as a sample in XAML just to kind of show you the horizontal layout, is that basically you've got, you know, sessions there, and you pick a session, and this was actually for a different conference, and you've got the time-based stuff up there. This is actually a list box in XAML right there, and I'll show you how to implement that in a few moments. But that's timeline patterns, so don't overlook that if there's time-related information. For instance, I see most conference sites, including the TechEd site, unfortunately, that list a whole bunch of sessions, but man, you've got no visualization about when they are or how they relate to one another. A timeline would be a far, far better interaction pattern for the TechEd site than what they have now. So let's see. It's timelines. Metaphors. Sometimes, especially in maybe simple consumer-based apps, you might want an interface that resembles something that's fairly familiar in the real world. This is the notepad, notebook, whatever you want to call it, on the iPad. And at first glance, you might actually think it was a real physical notebook because the metaphor overlaps like that. They even try to make sure that when you choose the note thing you want, it doesn't look like some artificial highlighting. It looks like a hand-drawn circle around the thing to highlight. So the metaphor pattern can be effective. You do want to be careful there. Don't get too cute with metaphors. That's one of the areas where you can do something and you think it's really cool and the user just gets tired of it in a hurry. I saw one of the early WPF apps I saw had a data entry screen, and in order to fill the data entry screen, a hand brought the screen down in front of you, and that's really cool the first time, and you don't, the second time it's kind of, and the third time you wish that hand would just go away and never come back. That's the principle that they came up with for Clippy is in the same vein, that they don't get too cute with metaphors, okay? There's only a fairly limited view, but there are certainly some places where metaphors are good, especially in the consumer world. More commonly used are maps. That's when an app is working with items laid out in the real world in some fashion. This is a screen snapshot from an interactive map at the Atlanta Zoo site, where it's a very natural navigation paradigm because people have that visual, spatial sort of understanding of the domain in place already. You can do real maps, of course. And by the way, if you're not aware of this and you do WPF development, doing Bing maps in WPF is childishly easy. There is a toolkit that you get, and you have to get this token to use it, and you can do Bing maps just in a heartbeat. See if I've got that up. I meant to load that and I forgot. I'm not sure if it's on this system or not. We'll see. Hang on. I'm shifting over to a new system, and sometimes I forget what I have and what I don't. So, simple Bing maps. Yeah, I've got this. So certainly, you're able to. Whoops, didn't really. You don't need to see that yet. What you need to see is the running app. I'll produce this app in about 20 minutes. Let's make the window a little bit bigger. So, you know, you got all the kind of zooming capability. You've got the ability to put your push pins on there that indicate your items, and you've got the ability to switch to the aerial view. All that's there, etc. So that's, as I said, I did that in about 20 minutes. The code for that is just ridiculously easy. That sample is out on my website, too. So if you do get into a situation where maps need to be your navigation paradigm, and you need real maps to put your items on, all you need is either lat long for the items or the address to go through geocoding to get the lat long, and then you can have a navigation paradigm using a map. It's really not something that you should be that concerned about implementing, it's, I think, quite a bit easier than you might expect. Now, a map, as you just what you just saw me do there with that map is an example of a navigation pattern called viewport. In viewport, you're basically looking at this big space. In the case of a map, it's the entire world. But it's some space that's bigger than the screen is expected to hold. So since the screen can't hold it all, the user is seeing some subset of the area, and they have the ability to pan around to change what part that they're looking at. And then zooming is often supported. Now, you can think of that in terms of maps as one possibility, but there's nothing to stop you from doing that in applications either. Here is an example. Oops, did I already have this loaded? I think I do, don't I? Yeah, there it is. It's already loaded. So I did this as kind of an example to show that you can have an application that's got various things on it, navigate to different pieces, zoom, pan around, let the user find what they want. The basic viewport pattern gives you a fair amount of flexibility in terms of letting the user, they can't get lost. The stuff is going to be there if they kind of, if they look for it enough. Oh, no, I guess I should mention one other thing about it in what you just saw. That it's very common that you need to provide differing levels. Then maps do this too. You've seen this. That at different levels of zooming, you change the nature of what you're displaying, the level of detail of what you're displaying. When you do that at the application level, it's called semantic zoom. So when I pull back far enough, then I go to that kind of a layout, and then as I get where I might be able to read it, then I change. See, we can go back and forth there. So we're going to see an implementation of this guy in a few minutes as well. So that's my completed list of patterns. On the viewport, I should mention a couple of indications for it, that the elements involved, if they are spatially or conceptually related, viewports work pretty well. If you've got more stuff than you can put on the screen, but you want to avoid context switching, viewport is one way to look at that. If the interaction needs multiple levels of detail with semantic zoom, the viewport can work pretty well for that. Do be cautious there. Consumption-based, content-based interactions work pretty well. Maps, of course, work well. But if the user is doing a lot of work on the surface, a viewport doesn't work as well. Make sure that the users have the technical capability to use the pattern. If they don't have a mouse scroll wheel, that zooming is going to be clumsy. I've got a little scroll bar at the bottom you can scroll with, but it's very clumsy. If you're doing it with touch, of course, they would typically use the touch pinch, but then you want to make sure that they're not trying to run it on some non-touch device, in which case they can't zoom. Now, I will mention one resource at this point that I want to get out of the way to make sure I don't overlook it. I used a couple of sample screens from this book for mobile apps. This is the Mobile Pattern Design Gallery by Teresa Neal. I do recommend this book as another resource for looking at all the different things you can do, not just for the overall interaction pattern, but for some of the other interesting patterns that you can use on a little more localized level. She covers that pretty well also. I would mention that if you buy the print version, the last time I looked, there was only a black and white print version available. But if you buy it in ebook format, you can get color if you have a color device like a Kindle Fire or if you want to look at it on your PC. And I recommend the color edition. I think you'll get a lot more value out of it if you do that. So that's a resource I do recommend that is in this general space. Now let's look at a couple of these implementations. Let's talk about how these things are done in XAML. As I said, if I don't show you some code, they'll kick me out. So in the timeline is basically done with the list box. I mentioned that when I showed the implementation. How many of you figured out the trick once I told you it was a list box? Did anybody figure out the trick? Yeah, because I already showed it, I think. You were in my training class. Of course you figured it out. So what you typically do is a list box can have any panel as its background, including a canvas or a grid. Now, if you do that, though, if you put the items on a canvas or a grid in the list box, now the items have to be responsible for positioning themselves on the surface. And you do that in what's called item container style. Now, some of you may not be as advanced in XAML and may not understand what some of this means. But what you're basically doing is setting attached properties in item container style to tell it where to go inside the panel that's being used for the list box. And normally what you have to have are some value converters that translate the time of an item and the duration of the item. You need to translate the time to know how far over to put it, and the duration to know how big to make it, how wide to make it. So you need value converters to do that. Let's take a look at that implementation that I had for you. The thing I showed a moment ago. Application kiosk, here it is. Well, let's shut down the application kiosk. There it is. A reminder again, now that's a list box, and I kind of put in some gratuitous stuff there for that. So shut that down, and I'll show you how it's done. We look at the main screen there, main window. There are a couple of list boxes in place, and that one is the main one right there. That list box is the session list box. You can see at the bottom down there that it is in fact a list box, and it has an item template that makes the items look like that, and an item source that just comes from some sample data. And if we look a little bit lower, let's get a little bit more room here. Then there's an items panel that says this list box uses a canvas to hold its items. And what that means is we have to have an item container style, which is, where is the item container style? There it is. It's this resource right here. If I go up to the top and see it, this resource. Yeah, there it is. It says, I'm positioning my canvas.top and my canvas.left based on, well, first of all, the vertical offset converter pushes it down based on the track. It takes the track in and converts that to a vertical offset. And the other converter takes the time in, and you can see that it's bound to the item time right there, and it converts it to a distance so it knows how far over that the item needs to go. And there's a similar converter in the data template that says how wide it needs to be. So that's the essentials for how you can make a list box look like a timeline. If your times are nicely chunked, you can do it with a grid instead and set grid row and grid column and row span and column span to determine what the items need to look like. That has the advantage that the items will size themselves very naturally. So that works out pretty well if your times are nicely chunked. But if your times are not as well chunked, then the more detailed layout is better. So that's the timeline implementation. For the other implementation, let's take a quick look at the viewport implementation. The basic essential elements of the viewport implementation are that you have, again, some kind of interesting combination of panels. In this case, what I'm doing is putting a grid inside a canvas, but the grid is much, much bigger than the canvas. Why a canvas? Because a canvas tells the rendering engine to render everything regardless of whether it's on the screen or not. So the canvas needs to be the viewport. That's the trick. If you try to put a little grid or big grid inside of a small grid, then you'll find that the rendering doesn't work right. So big grid inside inside canvas sized to the screen, there's a behavior available through Blend called mouse drag element behavior. I use that to let the surface be dragged around. Didn't do any work on that at all. I handle the mouse scroll wheel and manipulate a transform for zooming. And then I use the visual state manager that when the zoom factor is higher or lower than a certain amount, I change the visual state for the items so that they switch to either the pulled back state or the zoomed in state. Let's take a look at the XAML that does that. Oops, over here, Billy. Now, I have some more non-XAML stuff, by the way, for the folks who are leaving. It's not all XAML all the way out. I know there are people who don't care about XAML. I do. Okay, so here's... I love XAML. HTML5 is okay. If you beat on it long enough, you can do some pretty amazing things. So there you can see the visual state manager for this container for all the items. and it has a normal state and a pulled back state. When this state pulls back, we change the font size up to 60. Oh, did I? Oh, sorry. I've not put it on the thing, have I? Better put it over there so you can see it. Sorry. There we go. Visual state groups. There's the zoom states. Did you know in visual state manager, you can just make up your own states? Did you know that? So my zoom states include normal and pulled back. Pulled back says, yeah, what I'd like to do is animate the font size up to 60, and I'd like to animate opacity of certain things to zero, and you know, change some heights and widths and transform some things and move them around so that the visual state manager just handles all the animation when I switch to the pulled back state. Now, the only other really key element there is that when I go over to the main page and see what I'm doing, let's get rid of this so we've got a little bit more room. That this is where we handle the mouse wheel event. And what I'm doing is getting the current transform, and there are various kinds of transformations, transform objects that are attached to the render transform property in XAML. One of them is matrix transform. As I say, no one can tell you what the matrix transform is. You'll have to see it for yourself. So go to the help files and prepare to be totally baffled, because the help files for matrix transform are useless. They will tell you that there is a cell named M11, and they don't tell you what it does. M11 scales in X. There's M22, it scales in Y. And then there are offsets in a couple of the other cells, unless you rotate, in which case there are cosines involved. And I won't even get into that. So what I'm doing is grabbing the matrix that's going to let me do my zooming, finding out what the current zoom factor is out of that M11 cell, doing some calculations to determine what I need to do, I want to know if I'm below a certain minimum, I don't want to change the zoom factor. Otherwise, I divide by 10%, then change the cells to the new zoom factor. And then see if I need to change the state. If I'm making the zoom go down, the old zoom is bigger than the new zoom, and I get down to less than 0.5, I want to tell the visual state manager, please go to the pulled back state for all of the children that are zoom item containers. It just basically flips through all the children and tells them all to either go to one state or the other. Then there's the mirror image if I zoom upward. So that's the basic ideas there. You can do a viewport if you understand a little bit about panels, you know how to use behaviors, the mouse drag element behavior, and you know a little bit about transforms and the visual state manager. Now, let's talk a little bit about getting started with this. You've got a lot of options. Let's talk a little bit about the process in using it. When you start to try to evaluate your navigation options, I really do strongly recommend, look, I know you've got the habit. You just go to your chair and sit down and fire up Visual Studio or something electronic. I think it really does help to pull back, get some paper and pencil, and evaluate some of the potential options with paper and pencil storyboarding as a first stage. There are several different kinds of storyboards, but what they all are just very crude sketches of the different screens you need, the interaction pattern you're going to use, the relationships, and what you usually want to do is more than one attempt. Well, yeah, I could do it this way, or maybe I could do it this way, and here's a third possibility. Do a little bit of experimentation while the investment in experimentation is very, very low. The investment in storyboarding is extremely small. A couple of sheets of paper and a few minutes of your time. So do some investment in storyboarding to evaluate more than one navigation pattern. As I said, you can use my slides as your cheat sheet, so to speak. That you go through it and go, well, would that one work? No, that one might work. Let's do a little storyboard of what that interaction pattern would look for my application. So I do urge you to do a little bit of storyboarding. They're typically at a fairly crude level that you don't really worry much about layout. You're much, much more concerned with interaction, with the interaction pattern here, what the user is capable of doing in terms of interactions. There are several types of storyboard. Simple sequential, that would work if you were doing a wizard. A branching storyboard might work for context switching. If what the user can do is complex enough, for example, the content creation layout patterns, you might need state transition diagrams, or you might need a narrative storyboard. That means that there's objects in the real world that impact the user's process, that the user is scanning a check that has to go into an accounting system. So your storyboard includes both the screen and the scanner and how the user kind of goes back and forth. So spend a little time on storyboarding. Don't just assume that you can figure it out when you walk into Visual Studio. Do a little bit more thinking ahead of time, and I think you're more likely to hit upon an optimal navigation pattern for your particular case. Also, I think it's not bad at all to take multiple ideas to your users and let them kind of choose from among the multiple ideas. Have you ever been in that situation where you took your single prototype to the user and it was looked pretty much finished, and then they got into a food fight over the order of the fields and moved this thing 3 points over? How many people are familiar with that experience? Yeah. You can avoid that by showing multiple options and showing it in storyboards. All right, if you just don't really want to sketch, there's Sketchflow, there's Balsamic, there are other things you can use as tools. But they all have that common thing that what they show to the user looks like it's hand-drawn. And that psychologically tells the user, there's not much investment in this. This isn't anywhere close to finished. Therefore, I can fairly evaluate all the different possibilities and give some higher level, more valuable, sometimes more candid feedback. All right, so that's kind of how I would recommend that you get started. And I now have about 7 minutes at this point for questions. I've gone through pretty fast, so I would have some questions at the end. But this is Tech Ed. You're the cream of the Microsoft world here, so you can take the pace, right? At least now, along about Friday, you'll be brain dead and you couldn't do this session. Okay, questions? Please come to the mic, by the way, if you have questions. There are mics scattered around so that the people on the video can hear it. Over there?
Can I have your PowerPoints from the last two presentations?
They've been posted. The Tech Ed people have them. They'll be up. Other questions? Right there?
Hi. When you use patterns like Launchpad or Gallery where there's a lot of icons, do you have any rules for maximum number of items that a user can consume effectively?
Maximum number of items to consume effectively tends to be in the 5 to 6 range for typical users. Okay. After that, I'm trying to go to some kind of advanced grouping if I can.
Thank you.
Right there?
Yeah, so you were earlier when you were talking about the ribbon control, and you were talking about how you exposed those to the users and developers didn't like them, but your users really loved them when you put them up there. How does that contrast with all of this that we're hearing about Metro design, that there shouldn't be any of that Chrome or anything at all in the application, and that's you know, bad stuff?
Well, I think the general understanding is that Metro is aimed at a particular space that is touch optimized and optimized for consumption rather than applications in which people are doing real work and producing things. The iPad, for example, I think most people, when they get it, they don't even know what they're getting it for. Because I've talked to people and they went in and bought it, they didn't even know why they got it. So that's what Microsoft is up against as a competition. Therefore, they wanted something that would appeal to that particular grouping of users that are primarily consumption-based. So for that category of applications, there's nothing wrong with Metro's assumptions about the Chrome-less designs. Now, as you move on up into the complexity threshold, now some of the things in Metro begin to fall apart in terms of just not being suitable. And Microsoft will tell you that there's still room for desktop-type applications that are not going to satisfy what Metro expects you to do.
Well, to follow up, I guess our application has very few options, and I mean, I could actually see it fitting well into the kind of Metro assumptions, but if I were to bring back from this conference and say, here, you know, is a way to do this, their first thing would be our users like having the options. They like being able to see what they can and can't do. All the things that you were just saying. It's just hard, you know, I guess.
Let me kind of rephrase that from what I commonly hear. What the users will tell you is, please show me everything. And they will tell you that because they do not trust you. They do not trust you to show them what they need. They're afraid that if you put it somewhere else, they'll never find it. That fear in many applications is completely justified. So yes, they lack trust there. In order to get them over that hump, you must show them an interaction pattern that fits their workflow and that it's obvious and intuitive where they find all the things that they need. Until you've shown that, and that's typically quite a departure from what they have now, then you're not going to get them on your side. If you try to fiddle around the edges and just change the cosmetics, Yeah, your users are going to resist you every step of the way. There will be inertia. But if you go in with an interaction pattern tuned to them, because I've done this at many, many efforts that I've gone into, then when you fit the right pattern, your users will all of a sudden flip. I've had cases where they resisted fiddling around the edges for a year, 18 months, and then in 6 weeks you come up with something completely new, a new approach, and now all of a sudden they can't wait to get their hands on it. So that's the key there. Yeah, they don't trust you, and you have to take that into account. Over there?
Yeah.
We'll go back and forth.
We have a large legacy application that suffers from a lot of the sins.
You have a large what kind of application?
Legacy application.
Legacy app.
It suffers from a lot of the sins you've been describing. Do you have any recommendations as far as how to piecemeal move portions of an application so that portions of it look, have the old look and feel, and maybe a new piece of the app has a completely new, different look and feel?
No, I don't, actually. I've never seen that work. That what the users have to bite off on, if you do what I said and find the right pattern, is that there's going to be that pattern for a while, and it's intuitive enough that they don't have any trouble, and they're going to have to continue to use the old one until you shift things over. I have never seen any good way. I mean, you can certainly have your new pattern have holes in it where the old stuff gets put in. So you have new launch pads, you have new sort of context switchers, and then you're taking views that have fundamentally the old stuff. But in essence, I don't necessarily believe in changing the cosmetics on the old stuff much, because I want them to immediately know it's the old stuff, and that it will eventually be replaced. So no, I've not seen a really good answer to that.
Cool. Thanks.
Are you writing a book?
Am I writing a book? Yeah.
And navigation patterns.
I actually have plans for a three-part book, one on design principles, one on design process, and one on design patterns like this. But when will I get done with it? Gosh, when people stop paying me extortionate rates to come and fix their software, and I have time. Anybody there? Nope. Any more? We still have over a minute left. Going once? Going twice? Okay, you're welcome to come up here afterwards. Oh, I'm sorry, I got one more. Go ahead.
Do you have an example of a design pattern where you add items to a combo box?
Where you add what?
Items to a combo box. For example, I have a combo box with blue, red, green. I want to let the user add.
Add new items to it?
Yeah.
I don't have one handy. That mobile patterns thing actually has some interesting interaction things there. Another place to look for those kinds of patterns is the Quince site on Infragistics, quince.infragistics.com, which covers about 150 patterns. You might find an example there, but I don't have one just ready to hand.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more? Okay, you're welcome to call and ask some questions. Hope this has been helpful to you. Use that checklist. Make it easy for the users.